The following program is an MLWRadio.com production.
Powered by WrestleZone, it's Total Engagement with Matt Kuhn on the MLW Radio Network. This is the theme to my new show. The theme to my new show. Court Power called me up and said that I can have my own thing. It's almost halfway finished. How do you like it so far? How do you like the theme to my new show? Total Engagement.
Welcome again to Total Engagement with Matt Kuhn. You're still here. Thanks. I'm Matt Kuhn, and this is Total Engagement on the MLW Radio Network, powered by WrestleZone.com. And it's been an interesting week. It's been an interesting day. And just to give you a little insight into a day in the life of a fan who happens to have a podcast career, what I did today is I woke up at, 7:30 this morning, took my son to school, replaced a battery in a car, and then came inside and recorded a watch-along of a Raw, the Higher Power episode with Vince Russo. And then I went to work, which is, I taught music, maybe about 6 hours, came home, had dinner with my kid, watched some TV with my kid, interviewed Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, put my kid to bed, and then interviewed Tom Lawlor. Now, that's a pretty good day. It's a busy day, but I'd say it's a good day. I'm lucky to have it, and I'm lucky you guys are on this adventure with me, with Total Engagement. Now, the first couple episodes, I had a lot of bits, a lot of segments, and a lot of people really liked them. Some people didn't. So what we're going to do today is we're just going to have the interviews, because everybody loves the interviews. They love the Joey Ryan interview. They said they never heard one like that. Joey himself liked it. They liked the Lex Luger interview. So when I say interviews, I'm not messing around. We got some great interviews today. One thing you're going to hear is a little taste, a little preview of something we're going to do with Paul, Mr. Wonderful Orndorff. So you hear just a little bit of that. But you'll also hear Filthy Tom Lawlor, who's the MLW World Champion. He is fighting Low-Key this weekend in Chicago in a steel cage, March 2nd at Cicero Stadium. And also, we got the greatest of all time. We have Jim Johnston, musician to musician. I tried not to get too nerdy for the musician talk with the musician talk for all you, wrestling fans out there, but I had to get it in a little bit. But we talk about a lot of stuff, including his exit. And Jim, I call him Jim now, he's going to be appearing at StarCast 2 with Sean Mooney. You don't want to miss that live show. It's Behind the Themes with Sean Mooney, interviewing Jim Johnston at StarCast 2. So hopefully this episode, for those of you who like the interviews, will keep you a little happier. Something else happened, though. And I have a forum, so I guess I'll just talk about it a little bit. Either I got scammed out of some money, or a very crazy series of unfortunate events happened. And what really happened is that my son and I, for the sixth year in a row, are going to WrestleMania weekend. Luckily, we get to drive this year. And we are going to NXT and Ring of Honor, because I purchased some tickets to do so. But I didn't. I paid for the tickets. I just didn't get them. And I'm in the process of getting my money back and also figuring out how to go to these events. And telling my son today I actually didn't have the tickets when I thought I did and I thought they were coming was a very disappointing moment. So I got a little bit of my money back. I got to figure out how to get these tickets now, because they're way more expensive now. And I'll update you guys next week on if I got my money or not, and maybe who was the person who did that. But in any case, let's get back on a positive note. Something I try to do today, tonight, was call my good friend Conrad Thompson. Conrad has disappeared off the face of the earth. Now, I do know on good authority that he's fine. I don't know what he's thinking, what he's going to do now that Bruce Pritchard has gotten signed by the WWE. So I had a reasonable expectation that he would pick up the phone if I called, and because he usually does, and he would answer some questions if I asked them, which he normally would, combined with many, many insults of his own personal Baba Booey. That's me, Matt Kuhn. But I called him to put on the show, and I just went straight to voicemail. I was going to put that on the show, but it's not very entertaining. But since that didn't happen, we're just going to have the interviews. So we hope you enjoy the show today. Toll Engagement with Matt Kuhn. We have a couple new things going on as well. We have a brand new Patreon page, patreon.com/totalengage. If you want to support the show and get bonus content, some videos, early interviews, early shows, when I can do it early, I'm recording this at 1:37 a.m. on Wednesday. The show comes out as soon as I'm finished. But for instance, the entire Jim Johnston interview is up on audio and will be up on video tomorrow. Those are the kind of things you can expect on the Patreon site. Also, I started a new Toll Engagement Daily, a 5-minute daily show on YouTube. I don't have the custom URL yet. If you search Matt Kuhn and Toll Engagement, you'll find it. It'll be up every single day, no matter how tired I am. And now that's enough of me talking. Let's get to the show. Our first interview today is with Filthy Tom Lawler. Now, Tom Lawler is really my can't-miss podcaster. Of course, I don't miss Conrad's though. But Tom Lawler and the work he does with Brian Alvarez, I don't miss it. I find it entertaining. I find it funny. I find it insightful. I think Tom is a really interesting guy. He was on the short list of guys I wanted to interview when I started this show. He is the MLW World Champion. And this Saturday, March 2nd in Chicago, he is facing Lowkey and defending his newly won MLW World Championship in a steel cage. So make sure to check that out. MLW is where we host the show, and we want to support them. But I'll be honest with you, if their stuff wasn't good, I probably wouldn't talk about it. I like MLW, and you should definitely give them your support. Definitely support MLW, especially someone like Tom Lawler. Now, Tom Lawler started as a UFC fighter. He was on The Ultimate Fighter, and he has some strong opinions and some insights into how he looks at wrestling and MMA, not as diametrically opposed forces, but as an integrated philosophy. And the dude's been wrestling full-time since 2017. So obviously, he is one to watch. So without any further ado, let's go to Tom Lawler on Toll Engagement. In the UFC, Joe Rogan had called him the best weighing guy ever and the best walking guy ever. Today, as one of the hottest names in the wrestling world, he's the newly crowned MLW World Champion. And every week, you can listen to him, like I do, on the Filthy Four Daily Show on WrestlingObserver.com with Brian Alvarez. And this Saturday, March 2nd, in Chicago at Cicero Stadium, he's going to be defending that newly won title against Lowkey in your first title defense in a steel cage. Tom Lawler, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Matt. Thanks for having me. You know, like you said, I am one of the hottest prospects and one of the hottest stars in wrestling today. And I'm here to set this show on fire tonight.
Well, I definitely appreciate that, man. And, you know, as someone who, you know, takes copious notes for SmackDown every week with Brian Alvarez, you know, did you watch Raw last night? Did you see the closing angle? Do you have thoughts on that?
No, I didn't see any of it. My wrestling viewing has pretty much been cut down to SmackDown and very limited other things at this point. I just have so much going on with traveling, wrestling, wrestling all across the U.S. I just got back from Europe last week. I'm working at the gym at Syndicate MMA, training in mixed martial arts, you know, training with other guys. It's always a wild time for me. So no, I haven't watched Raw, I don't think, for well over a year.
Well, I definitely understand. You know, I listen to you every week on Wrestling Observer. You know, of course, you said you watch SmackDown. Is there a part of SmackDown these days that you look forward to, you know, a favorite part, or is it all just the same right now?
You know, I look forward to the show overall because it is one of the limited times that I do get to sit down and watch wrestling and kind of focus just on that. So even if, sometimes Brian and I pick things apart, I'm still a fan, a big time fan. And, of course, I always look forward to seeing Daniel Bryan out there. I look forward to virtually everything. You know, I want the WWE to be the best that it can. You know, I think a lot of people listen to either Bryan or myself or, you know, a number of people, Dave, Lance, anybody, and think that, like, you know, people on the Wrestling Observer website or Figure Four Online Wrestling website don't want the WWE to succeed. And that's like the furthest thing from the truth. You know, that's the furthest thing from reality. So.
Yeah, I definitely
agree. I look forward to it all. That's my answer.
Well, that's a good answer. You know, and you said you're a fan, and your career is really interesting to me, you know, with the UFC, but also wrestling. It's not like you were this guy who just did UFC and then you got into wrestling as a result. Like, you wrestled before. As a kid, were you more of a wrestling fan or an MMA fan?
Well, I grew up in a unique time where, you know, basically as I was hitting my teenage years, the UFC started. So, they always just coexisted. They were the same thing. Some people view them as like separate entities, but I mean, in reality, it's combat sports, you know, boxing, mixed martial arts, pro wrestling, they're all birds of the same feather, if you will, more so than being separate. So I've been a fan of all of those things, kickboxing, everything, K1, sumo. I mean, I'm a fan of every combat sport that you can think of.
You know, and that reflects itself in the fact, you know, you went to University of Florida, you know, you wrestled, you had a lot of success there. It's almost like you weren't limiting your options. Were you looking at that time to get into one or both worlds?
At the time that I graduated from college, which was like 2005, 2006, in Japan, the two were intermingled more than ever. You know, to the public, because there was Pride Fighting Championships and the, you know, a lot of professional wrestling leagues were using MMA fighters at the top of the card. So it was an avenue into both, I thought, become a legitimate fighter, get some legitimate skills, and then, you know, hopefully get into Pride or, you know, a big organization in Japan, and then make my way into wrestling. Well, unfortunately, the UFC purchased Pride and it died before I got a chance to live out that fantasy that I had. So, you know, then my life took a different course.
So as someone who grew up in the States, but was into Pride, was into Japanese wrestling, were you just a total like nerd for, you know, combat sports when you were younger? Were you getting tapes? Were you trying to find all you could?
Yeah. I had tapes. I had VHS tapes of Rings, King of Kings. That was my favorite tournament. I actually may or may not have them downloaded on my computer right now. Those are like my all-time favorite events in wrestling or combat sports or anything, because it was this weird rule set. It was the first time that they did it where, like, you know, you could fight, and if you didn't wear gloves, you could only open hand strike. And if you wore gloves, you could punch. And, you know, there was other weird rules. There was rope breaks. There's, you know, a ton of bizarre stuff. And you'd have all these weird, crazy characters from different countries. You had, you know, Sambo guys from Russia out there submitting Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belts in like 15 seconds, you know, and the guy from Russia looks like his nickname was Grandpa Shoemaker. And that's what he looked like. So, you know, you've got that guy out there winning fights, and you've got, you know, crazy, you've got Japanese pro wrestlers out there. I mean, there was just everything you could think of, you know, out there fighting against each other. And, you know, that's what initially drew me, and I'm sure many other people, to the UFC. And really, that's what draws people to wrestling as well. You have different characters. Not everybody needs to be the same. Not everybody should be the same. And MMA is kind of just, or began as an extension of that. Oh, you got the karate guy. Well, he's going to fight against the sumo guy. He's going to fight against the kickboxer. And in wrestling, you have, well, the trash guy is going to fight against the sumo wrestler here. And then the sumo wrestler is going to fight against some guy who's really into birds, you know? So you had all these weird matchups. And really, like I said earlier, they're all just the same thing, you know?
You kind of approached your wrestling and your MMA for a more organic, kind of big picture type thing. Do you think that's been helpful to you?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I could have been better. Maybe I could have been better at one or the other if I would have just, you know,
focused.
But, you know, I mean, what's everybody's definition of success? I would say that I have not been successful, but I'm sure there's some people who would say that I have. So I don't really know. I don't have a good answer for that one.
So what does success look like to Filthy Tom Lawler?
That's a good question. I'll let you know when I find it. The older that I get, the more that I realize, you know, what wasted opportunities that I've allowed myself to have passed through my fingers. You know, I can blame in mixed martial arts, you know, there's a system that involves judges, and it's sometimes arbitrary as to what they, you know, it's completely arbitrary in some ways, when they choose who wins the fight. So it's very tough to, I'm not quite sure what I'm getting at now, but, I don't know. Move on.
Were you, you know, in saying that Pride was purchased by the UFC, you know, the Ultimate Fighter, of course, you know, the season one was a real groundbreaker, you know, as far as entertainment value and unleashing the UFC to a wider audience. It was almost like then it was treated almost like a farm system. Was that your only way to get in the UFC, was going through that Ultimate Fighter?
No, not at all. But it was just like at that point, it was the best way. Nowadays, it's a different world. You have that, like the Dana White Tuesday Night Contender Series out there as well. And Tuff just doesn't produce as many people. The UFC just scoops them up, throws them right in there, trying to find the next star. So, sorry. Stepped on something out here. So, sorry about that. So they're looking, you know, to find the next star quickly. So, you know, Tuff just isn't, it's not what it used to be. But at that time, it was like the best option that you had. It was getting yourself on television and also getting yourself a foot in the door with the UFC.
And at that time, were you open to pro wrestling stuff too, or were you just primarily focused on that UFC thing?
Well, at that point, I had been fighting, professionally for, I don't know, a little over a year, maybe 2 years, 18 months, something like that. And I hadn't done much professional wrestling. I think about 2 years maybe before I was in the UFC, I had a WWE tryout, and basically, you know, just it's the same story as many other people, like, hey, we'll call you back. And then, you know, hey, we want you to work on some stuff and this and that in the future. We'll get back to you. And, you know, I figured I'd rather do something where I could control my own destiny, like mixed martial arts. Not realizing that that's not always the case.
It definitely didn't turn out to be the case, you know. With that WWE tryout, where was that? Who was there? What are your recollections of it?
It was at Deep South, when they had Deep South as the developmental territory. The tryouts were different, I think, than they are now. Now they're like large casting calls, maybe sometimes, or, you know, unless they just bring you right in. Then I was sent down there, and I think I was the only guy there, or like trying out, running all the drills and stuff with the people. But, the rest of the guys were already under contract. They were wrestling, you know.
Was it Bill DeMott then at Deep South?
Yeah.
And, you know, they just did that, said they'll call you later, and they didn't. That's as you said, a pretty typical story. But the Ultimate Fighter was kind of a good experience for you, you know. Even though, you know, you lost out to Ryan Bader early on, you got in the house, you got yourself on TV, you got your personality across, you got on the special. That was kind of your entryway into the mainstream. And I think looking back, that's probably a positive experience for you.
Yeah, I guess so. you know, like I said, it kind of hot shotted me to where I wanted to be. And I could look back and like I was saying before I got sidetracked and lost my train of thought. You know, there's a lot of opportunities where I can look back now that I'm older and say that I floundered, you know, or I'm the one that blew the opportunity. You know, I was talking about judges in MMA, you know, deciding the fights, but, you know, fighters can always complain about the judges and fans, you know, kind of give them a little bit of leeway too as well. But, you know, I could always now go back and go, well, you know what? I should have done more. I, you know, shouldn't have gone out that night and partied. I should have taken my diet more seriously, you know, stuff like that. Whereas like before I couldn't do that. So, you know, looking back, you know, now I'm sure, I guess, I think the Ultimate Fighter was a good experience, but it's the only one that I know. So, you know, it got me to where I wanted to be at the time. And, you know, I think it was the right choice for me at the right, you know, at that time. It got me more fights and it got me more over, I guess, with the UFC crowd, because they get to see a little bit of my personality and see that I wasn't just a stick in the mud like so many MMA fighters are when it comes to, you know, their ability to talk to people and, you know, just basically to be a normal person.
Yeah, I think the key is, you know, in watching you over these years, is that you don't take yourself as seriously. And I think maybe there's a good and bad side about that. Maybe you weren't as laser focused as you could have been, but I think it helped you in the long run. Where did you develop that kind of free expression, you know, that creativity, the flair for entertainment that you kind of bravely brought to the UFC? Was that something you always had?
Well, I mean, it's funny you put it that way because, like, I could easily look at it the opposite way. Like you said, you know, maybe I could have been more laser focused. You know, a lot of people would always say to me, like, you know, maybe if you would have spent more time training and less time thinking about your entrances, you could have won that fight. And it's like, that's such a stupid thing to say because, you know, the amount of time that I actually spent thinking and planning the entrances is so minute compared to the amount of time that I spent training. But there are other, you know, kind of like outs that you can give yourself, whether it was like, you know, diet or not getting enough sleep or, you know, just small things that add up over time that can really affect you. So yeah, I don't know. It's kind of weird to always look back on the career and try to analyze it.
Well, you know, it's an easy cop out, you know, or it's an easy criticism that someone on the outside can make and just say, oh, well, he took too much time on his entrances.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a real thing, but maybe it reflected a little bit. Did the UFC feel that way? Did they appreciate your entertainment value?
Hell if I know, but one thing you said before was like, you know, maybe you not taking yourself so seriously helped out in the long run. And it's, you know, I look at it very, very differently than that. You know, the professional wrestling side of me that I brought was part, you know, that was serious. You know, I was doing that for a reason. I'm not stupid, you know? And also like that also makes it sound like I, you know, didn't take training seriously. And if there's one thing that I do take seriously when it comes to fighting or pro wrestling, it is training. You know, maybe my diet sucks. Maybe my sleep schedule sucks. Maybe I don't stretch or I don't take care of myself or, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, I do take myself, my career, my training very seriously.
So. Well, I guess what I was meaning was, you know, you don't take yourself so seriously that you're afraid to put yourself out there, that you're afraid to be entertaining, that you're afraid to be seen as a personality.
Well, yeah, I've basically stolen other people's stuff, though. So, I mean, don't give me too much credit here.
Well, you didn't invent the Shockmaster, you know.
Exactly, and a Hulk Hogan entrance, an Apollo Creed entrance.
That was great.
Everything that I've done that's been good has been stolen. The Dan Severn weigh-in, Conor McGregor weigh-in. I mean, there's so many things. People always go, oh, wow, that's so creative. And it's like, are you paying attention? Everything that I've done was stolen. I stole a Genki Sudo entrance that was a parody or a mock of Buckethead. You know, so there's like, there was one that was like an inception. It was like a, you know, a entrance within an entrance.
With what you're saying, as far as you're not a dummy, anybody who listens to you for more than 5 minutes, you know, talking about wrestling or reviewing food or whatever it is you do, you know, that day with Brian, you know, knows you're not a dummy. So how much of that kind of stuff was for fun, and how much of it was this purposeful kind of marketing yourself and getting yourself more attention and trying to build your brand? Was any of that at work for you?
Well, I didn't think of it in that way at that time. But one thing that I was always told in pro wrestling, and I'm sure everybody's heard it, is you want to take yourself and turn it up to 11. Take your personality and turn it up to 11. And basically, you know, I'm a fan of pro wrestling and MMA. So what more should I do than copy pro wrestlers and MMA fighters when I did my entrances and stuff like that? So, you know, part of it is just being myself and taking that advice, but that also seems to be the best advice that you can get when it comes to things of that nature.
With that perception, you know, the you need to train more instead of doing your entrance more. Did that leak over to, you know, you felt the UFC people maybe didn't take you as seriously as you deserved to because you did these, you know, kind of outlandish things at the walk-ins and weigh-ins? Do you feel like you weren't taken as seriously as maybe you should have?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's tough to say because I'm not really quite sure what most of the people behind the scenes in the UFC thought of me. Besides, you know, I'm sure that there's people in like the menial jobs working during fight week that liked me because I wasn't a total asshole to them. But, you know, I don't really know what the upper management thought or anything like that. I don't know if they thought I was a terrible fighter. I don't know if they, you know, wished I was the first person to die in the octagon. I have no clue what the hell they thought. So it's tough to say.
That's a little morbid, but yeah, I guess anything's possible. With your, you know, your ascent in UFC, you know, of course we'll talk a little bit about, you know, why it didn't work out, but if things had worked out with you in UFC, you were happy being there. That is what you want to do. You had goals with that. You had no, you probably weren't going to wrestle, or did you still have wrestling kind of in the back of your mind?
Well, I didn't really know what the UFC was going to do regarding me. I thought that they were going to, you know, give me more fights and keep me under contract. And then, lo and behold, one random day, you know, I get released. So I really didn't have any plans because it was about 2 months out from the suspension that I was under being up. And I had asked and asked for months about getting a fight and then kind of just put it off. They didn't, you know, say, hey, we're in the process of cutting you. So, I don't really know what the hell was going to happen.
And of course, what you're referring to is your suspension. You were, you know, suspended by the UFC, as you've talked about a lot, by a USADA drug test, out of competition, you know, 17 picograms. We all know what picograms are now. Of Osterine, you wrote 17 picograms of Osterine got me 2 years. You wrote that on Twitter in response to John Jones. That was something, a situation that was, you still feel was kind of unfair to you, even independent of the John Jones situation. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, if you take a look at other similar situations, they've been handled a little differently. And, you know, basically I just feel like, nobody, you know, basically people are willing to bend over backwards, for people if it's going to make them money. And apparently nobody looked at me like that. So, I wasn't given any preferential treatment whatsoever. And you know, it is what it is at this point. I still don't know how or what I took or ate or drank that caused me to test positive for it. But, I've tried not to think about it very much at this point because, hell, I did my time. And I feel like, you know, like the guy who gets convicted of murder and claims he didn't do it, and lo and behold, gets released 20 years later. You know, I'm waiting for some substance out there, like a commonly eaten or drinking substance to come back, you know, containing it. And then I'll be like, oh, well, you know, that was probably the culprit. But at this point, I try not to think about it too much because it's like there's no positive that came of it. In most ways. So.
It's like you're wandering around looking for the one-armed man, you know, and trying to figure out.
Yeah.
It's still very much a mystery to you. With you being gone those 2 years, first of all, that length of suspension, that was surprising to you?
Well, in retrospect now, I mean, yeah. at the time, that's what's written in the rules, you know. But now there's been cases since then which have had lesser suspensions and, you know, were just handled differently than mine was. And yeah, now looking back, it's clear that it's unfair.
And of course, we're referring to what happened with John Jones, where he had 33 picograms of Turnabol, which is an animal.
Okay. There's also Sean O'Malley, okay, and I'm glad that actually he got off because I'm sure it's like probably a similar instance to what happened with me, but he got, I think, 6 months, and like the DA in Nevada came in and said like that should be like the normal time that you should be suspended. So, I mean, what the fuck?
Why do you, can you see anything outside of the fact that you don't see you were valued as a reason why you're kind of given that hammer? Like, was there anything personal going on, or maybe you didn't play the politics the way other people did? Any other thing you can think of that might have led to the kind of unfair treatment by the UFC of you?
Well, no, I mean, I think that they, you know, they just went by the letter of the law and like, hey, you know, this is the deal with this guy. You know, I think that the UFC, like the department that handles it, and, you know, Jeff Nowitzki at this point,
right,
I think his credibility kind of needs to be put into some sort of question. And he was the one that gave me some advice on a lot of the stuff. And, you know, thinking back now, it's like, well, I was basically advised like not to go to arbitration because I didn't have a substance to pinpoint, you know, the positive test on, like a contaminated supplement or something like that. So I was advised not to go to arbitration. Well, I mean, John Jones went to arbitration without a substance and look what happened with him. You know, Josh Barnett was able to beat, their, you know, sentencing, but he had the substance, but we've seen cases where now guys have, especially with John Jones specifically, have not had the substance and they've still given him a reduced sentence. So, you know.
And this guy Nowitzki is, you know, the UFC medical guy, right, who you know, is the guy who's with Dana White talking about the picograms and everything, and he's talking to you and giving you advice saying don't go to arbitration. But meanwhile, in today's day and age, he's you know, reconciling 33 picograms of John Jones as being normal. So a guy with no kind of consistency or convenient consistency when it fits the UFC narrative.
Exactly. Convenient consistency is a very good term there.
So, go ahead.
Hey, and to borrow a term from Brian, my friend Brian Alvarez, I'm sure he's a nice guy, but you know, now looking back at the way it was handled, I've got to pose some questions. I mean, it's my life, damn it.
For sure, you know, and you're like, you know, like I say, you're a funny guy. You're outgoing. You were known for being, you know, funny and entertaining. But this is something when you talk about that is a sore subject to you, and I don't mean to keep dwelling on it, but how did this thing change you as a person? Like this experience, I mean, it sounds like a real kind of just slap in the face that you can't ever slap back. Have you been changed by this whole UFC thing that happened?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, whether it came off or not to anybody, I mean, for the better part of 2 years, I was miserable. Just, you know, absolutely miserable on the inside, depressed. Hated life, hated myself, hated everything. And, you know, being able to get in there and fight again, even though it wasn't in the UFC, was very, like, a liberating experience for me. So I'm glad that I was able to do that. But yeah, I mean, it sucked. It was a living nightmare. I just remember the very, like the worst, the absolute worst part of it was, I was scheduled to have my, B sample tested in LA, and it was set to be like the day of my daughter's birth. So, my daughter, is born. So I have to like, you know, in a panic, like, you know, instead of celebrating her birth, I've got to email USADA or whoever it was and try to get them to change the date of the testing. Then it's, you know, 3 days later or whatever, I have to drive to LA. And right before I go to leave to LA, I get the call from, I'm guessing it was Novitski. I can't remember exactly. Telling me that, you know, the substance that they had tested that we thought was going to come back positive with Austrian came back negative. So it's like, that was my one shot. And I'm driving, you know, I'm about to leave to drive to LA to go watch my B sample be tested, you know, to watch my frozen urine be run through 30 different machines and turned into a solid and then turned back into a liquid. It probably got turned into a gas at one point. I have no fucking clue. I mean, I don't know what was going on here. But I had to drive 5 hours out to LA knowing that this thing was just going to come back positive again. It was like driving to my own funeral. It was the worst.
And taking you away from something that you definitely didn't want to miss.
Yeah. I mean, it was just the worst case scenario. Like I had forgotten the portion of my daughter being born because I've like cast out all joy, you know, from that drive over there. But I was looking through my emails a week or two ago, and I saw that in there.
So. With what happened with John Jones, where not only did they, you know, change the definition of what, you know, a failed test was, but they actually moved the entire event to get this star in there, this money-making star in there. On the surface, as somebody who doesn't know a lot about the ins and outs of UFC, I don't think there's any context for that in the history of sports. I think it looks like the most crooked thing I've ever seen. Is there any other possible interpretation of that situation than it is just crooked as hell?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't want to just keep getting into it too much, but just go start at the history of the UFC, start at the beginning, and just go through the whole thing. I mean, there's plenty of crooked stuff that was done, whether it was the way the company was acquired, you know, by Zuffa, or, you know, a lot of other things that have just been going on throughout the history of the company. So, and like I said, it's much like WWE. Don't get me wrong. I was thinking about this earlier today, actually, because I'm usually very, very negative, or people view me as very negative on the UFC, but I love the UFC. But I just want everything to be the best that it can, and there's no reason why it can't, you know? There's no reason why wrestlers can't have health care. There's no reason why fighters can't have health care. It doesn't have to be, you know, all one-way traffic for the promoters, and it doesn't have to be all one-way traffic for the fighters either. You know, there needs to be compromises on both sides. And it just seems like there's nobody willing who's in charge to keep the people underneath them happy whatsoever. And you see that with the UFC. You see a lot of fighters complaining about not only the pay, but now the matchmaking, the lack of opportunities and fights given to him, placement on cards, because that affects, you know, income, it affects visibility. There's a lot of different things that go into, you know, mixed martial arts and where you're placed on a card or on what show it's on and what city, you know. So it's just like a very, very unhappy place, it seems like, at this point. And it shouldn't be. It doesn't have to be. And I don't want it to be.
You draw parallels, you know, throughout your life and career, you know, wrestling, mixed martial arts, and you just drew another one, UFC, WWE. Is it probably the case in your mind that the reason that those problems exist is because both of those industries have one large company that is completely dominating the entire industry?
No. I don't. I think it's just, it's like some, well, basically, I mean, the UFC patterned itself business-wise after the WWE model. So I just blame it on that.
So, yeah, you know, speaking of wrestling, you know, you were got that suspension November 2016. A few months later, February, you started wrestling in February 2017. As you start to wrestle, is that something you're glad you're doing, or you just have the eye for the UFC and you're just like, I'm biding my time until I get back?
Well, I was going to be what I was going to be able to do. You know, I'm not one at my age and my point in life to pass up any sort of opportunity. So basically I was looking for the best opportunity that I could. If the UFC was going to sit me on the shelf and screw me and not give me the release that I requested for until like 18 months later, that's cool. I was going to find something else that I could do in order to make money and keep my name out there. So, you know, if I had gone back to the UFC, I'm sure I would have brought in new fans, you know, and you can't say the same for a lot of fighters out there nowadays. So, you know, I think that was kind of the way that I looked at it. I was going to try to make a positive out of it either way that I could, you know.
With you wrestling now, you've been doing the MMA thing primarily up to this point. How did you get ready to wrestle? Who did you train with to kind of get back in the ring again after kind of a bit of an absence?
Well, I went to the Future Stars of Wrestling school here in Vegas, but I think I probably went maybe like 20 times. I really didn't have much time due to, you know, working at the gym and training mixed martial arts as well. Luckily, the rolls and bumps and that stuff kind of came back naturally, because I do that stuff, you know, on a daily basis in the gym. I lift up and I put down people safely who don't want me to lift them and put them down. So lifting people up and putting them down when they allow you to is a little bit easier. You know, I know when I've hit somebody too hard, and I know when I haven't hit somebody hard enough in order for them to react. So, you know, I think mixed martial arts training is very undervalued, when it comes to wrestling training itself here in the U.S. at least. So I kind of just supplemented my MMA training with some wrestling training. And then, once I got back into the ring, you kind of realize, well, your body can only take so much in the long run, and, you know, bumping over and over is not good for you. So, you know, I kind of cut down on the wrestling training I was doing and, you know, kind of refocused on MMA training as my suspension was coming up. So, you know.
In May of 2017, you know, you start with MLW. As you're wrestling, you're I think a commodity. I think you're well known. Were there any other companies you were looking at, or any other companies that were looking at you when you started with MLW?
Well, I mean, if you remember back when MLW started, it wasn't quite what it is now.
It was just like a show every couple months, right?
Yeah. So at the time, I was just, you know, working virtually everywhere that I could, and it wasn't like MLW had, you know, a big, huge future outlook. So at that point, you know, things were a little bit different. So I was just trying to go anywhere that I could as quickly as I could. And like I said, you know, try to turn the negative that I was placed into a positive. And, you know, now, 2 years later, now it seems like my schedule's really picked up, you know, not only with MLW, but with, you know, virtually, you know, companies, I'm booked virtually every weekend at this point. And, you know, there was a time where in wrestling, that wasn't a viable thing. So, you know, I'm very lucky that I think I came along at this time, especially now with so many guys being picked up by other avenues. You know, it's kind of allowed me a chance to show my character in MLW and for people to see that. And like I talked about earlier, with MMA, it's a lot of times, you know, even if your pay is better on the undercard, the visibility, you know, that you have in certain venues or the chance you have in front of certain crowds is more beneficial. And, you know, I think that I'm one of the people who really has benefited the most from being in MLW, clearly.
With the MLW has this, you know, they court talks about it a bit, this open door policy type deal. What is your agreement with MLW? You can take independent bookings, but not in competition, or I know everybody's thing is different. What is your deal with MLW as far as that goes?
Yeah. I mean, the only restrictions are you know, WWE is off limits. I believe I'd have to go back and read it. But I believe it's like anybody with a national, you know, a real national TV deal, maybe. I can't remember exactly. But it, like, you know, yeah, I'm happy where I'm at. So it's not, there's no, like a lot of people, especially now with AEW coming around, are looking to, you know, either get out of their contracts in certain places, whether it's, you know, Lucha Underground or WWE or MLW or Impact or anywhere, essentially. And a lot of times people always think, and I can attest to this when it comes to MMA as well, they think that the grass is greener. And like I talked about earlier, that's not always the case. Sometimes it matters where you're at a certain time. And I think that that's been, you know, one of the best things as far as MLW goes with me. Now there are other, like, you know, instances, some companies will not use you because you work for MLW. So despite MLW not having restrictions, you know, some other places have their own restrictions.
You don't strike me as a guy who has, you know, who's great at the long-term goal thing, you know, like, it sounds like you just go full speed ahead and, you know, maybe as you get older, that's changing a little bit. But now that you're wrestling a lot, you know, and you know, the occasional MMA fight, what are your long-term goals as far as wrestling goes? What is it that you see as kind of the, you know, end point or the dream, as it were?
Well, one of the beauties of looking at MMA and wrestling as one thing is that I can answer this question very simply by saying I'm looking to make the most money doing whatever one I can do, you know, and that's basically all that it boils down to.
That's probably the best answer I've ever, like, heard.
Yeah. It's the true one. You know, you ask me tomorrow, if I'm having a really good day, MMA training, maybe I'll be like, hey, you know, I should stick with this MMA thing. Or, you know, if I have a really good match and I walk away thinking, oh, that was a blast. You know, the crowd was going crazy. Maybe wrestling is for me full time. But at the end of the day, I love them both. So why give them up? I'm already married. So I'm going to be with one woman for the rest of my life. Why do I need to pick one sport?
Right. And if the opportunities are there, you know, and opportunities keep presenting themselves, With MLW, I was in attendance. My son was in attendance. As you won the MLW World Championship, I guess the belt is too heavy to carry, I heard on your show. But how do you feel being trusted to be kind of the standard bearer at this point for MLW as their champion, so kind of early in your full-time career?
Yeah, well, I try not to think about these things as I'm in the middle of it. One of the things I'm sure I'll always remember texting Brian this. I'm not quite sure why I even texted him. It was just out of nowhere. But I said, like, look, I'm sure in like 10 years, I'm going to think that this point in my life is really cool, being able to go out there. I think this is after I won the Battle Riot, actually. You know, saying I went out there and I wrestled against Kevin Sullivan and Conan and the Spirit Squad and all these things. And, you know, my best friend from high school was in the crowd there watching me win the Battle Riot. And, you know, we used to do backyard wrestling together. And we started wrestling training together. And then he flaked out because he's a pussy. So there's all these, you know, awesome things that I could have been thinking about. But I'm just sitting there and it's like, you know, when you're in it, you need to not think about those things. You can't get emotional about it. You know, you have to kind of look at the bigger picture. And that's what I try to do. I try not to think about these things too much to let it seep in, because I'll have time to do that in the future. I'll have time to look back and reminisce, but now's not the time to do that.
It definitely isn't. This Saturday, you are facing Low-Key, of course, in Chicago at Cicero Stadium in a steel cage. Have you been in many steel cage matches?
I've been in, I believe, one steel cage match, and it was also a weapons battle royal.
So you're duly prepared, is what you're saying?
Oh yeah. Oh, I'm ready. The Florida Rumble in the Cage, I believe, is what it was. I believe the one that I was in was won by Eric Stevens of food eating fame currently. So yeah, it's a weapons battle royal inside of a steel cage, eliminated by being thrown through the door or over the top. I believe I brought a stoplight as my weapon of choice that had been blown down in a hurricane.
Well, yeah, a stoplight is no more crazy than a stop sign, really. You know,
I cut myself open pretty badly on the stoplight. The thing was huge. I'm talking, those things are so heavy. It was like at least 100 pounds, probably like 120 pounds or something like that. It was hard as hell to carry in there. I bear hugged it and I got it out there. I was gassed. I put it in the corner. It's like full steel, right? And I'm thinking, it's like, okay, there's like a steel lip over the lights themselves to stop the glare, I guess. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to put my head through that light. Well, I missed. And I cut myself on like the lip that sticks out. The light like barely broke. I bled all over the place. I've got a scar on the top of my head from it. And yeah, that's the last time I was in a cage match, now that I think about it.
So,
besides every fight that I've had in recent memory.
That's very true. And a little bit different from getting powerbombed in a bar on a speaker by Ken Shamrock.
Oh, Jesus. There we go. I'm trying to forget about that too. You know how I talked about USADA, the USADA suspension being a poor subject with me? This is also a sore subject here.
And that was a audible that Mr. Shamrock called. Is that my understanding on that powerbomb?
Well, the idea was, I told him, like, if we're by the bar, you go put you in a triangle and then like put me, like slam me on the couch over there, you know? Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure he didn't hallucinate. I think there was a couch. Maybe the triangle choke was so tight that he was started seeing things and thought that he was putting me on a couch, but there was no couch there.
And you were powerbombed on top of a speaker cabinet.
No, I was powerbombed on the floor.
On the floor, off the speaker. Was it?
Yes.
Goodness. So with the cage match coming up, that's against Low-Key. You beat Low-Key in Philadelphia at the old ECW arena. What is it like being in the ring with someone as high impact with Low-Key? It's to me, with, you know, I don't know much about anything other than being a fan, but it seems like in MMA, the point is to not get hurt. And in wrestling, if you're doing it right, you still get hurt. What is it like being in the ring with Low-Key?
I love that. what's it like being in the ring with somebody as high impact as Low Key? I mean, I think it's going to depend on who you ask that question to. Me, I'm used to it. You know, I'm used to being hit at high impact speeds by objects that I was not necessarily aiming to be hit by. So it's much the same. So it's like, you know, my everyday life and in there with Low Key. I'm sure that some people are scared off by it or scared off by him and his intensity, but luckily I'm not one of those people.
And you've been really generous with your time. I want to thank you a lot. Of course, everybody check out this weekend, MLW. You can go and get tickets from MLWtickets.com in Cicero Stadium in a cage against Low Key. Before you go, I got to ask you one more question, if you don't mind.
Sure. What's this going to be?
I was fortunate enough at the Hall of Fame this year to have a conversation with one Glenn Jacobs. And I understand that you have an appreciation for this man, Kane, in the ring, above most others. What is it about Kane that you love so much?
I think I've answered this other places or other times, but I will gladly, once again, let everybody know why they should love Kane as much as I. If you look back, and I dare you to, I implore you to, I want you to go back and analyze every single wrestler's career in the history of not only the WWE, but wrestling itself. And I dare you to find somebody who has gone through worst gimmicks, worst storylines, and come out shining on top every single time and done not only a professional job, but a fantastic job in their role like Glenn Jacobs has. I don't think you can find somebody who's done it. I don't think you can find somebody who played a disgusting dentist, who, you know, played the Undertaker's brother, was a demon, and then was a comedy figure at the same time, or, you know, in the same character. There's just been so many instances in which Kane has been given just terrible material, you know, bad ideas, and he has shined each and every time.
Well, I'm hoping we see you do a walkout or a press conference again, and you get to dress up as Kane.
I got a question for you, Matt.
Sure.
How did you feel about corporate Kane?
I didn't love corporate Kane, but he did kill it, though. Like, he was all in on it, you know?
Exactly. You weren't supposed to like him. He was the best at his job.
That's fantastic, man. And I really appreciate your time. I know how busy you are. You know, you've got the Filthy Four with Brian Alvarez on Wrestling Observer. You're wrestling. You're training. You're at the gym. So thank you again, Filthy Tom Lawler, for being here. I hope you enjoy this at least a little bit.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. Way better than the last one I did, so.
I appreciate that. Really a great interview with Tom Lawler. And what's fun about this, I hope, is that you can see what a fan I am of him. And I tried to be, you know, honest and ask the questions that people wanted to hear. But at the same time, like I said, I'm a fan of him and I really believe in his future. Now, a lot of people are looking forward to the next interview with Jim Johnston. But first, let me explain what we're going to do on a future show.
Total engagement.
So here is something that's coming up on a future episode of Total Engagement. And it's something that's important to me. And I hope it's also important to you. And it began when I was working for something to wrestle with and Bobby Heenan passed away. And I made a tribute song. People liked it. People were touched by it. But all the compliments I heard about Bobby Heenan, all the over-the-top accolades, which weren't really over-the-top because they're accurate, that were given to Mr. Heenan. And I thought to myself, it's a shame. It's a shame that people don't do that when people are here. So soon, it might be next week, it might be the week after, we are going to do our first living tribute to one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. And for the first one, I wanted to choose my favorite wrestler when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I was such a Paul Orndorff fan that I would tell people sometimes that I was related to him. I was such a fan of him. I can talk about why. I'll probably talk about it a little bit on the tribute show. But I got to interview Mr. Orndorff actually today, and we'll give you a little preview of that. Do you think maybe they should have given you the belt and let Hogan chase you a little bit with the belt?
Yeah, they should have. But you know, listen, you know why they didn't?
Why?
Because I was that good that I didn't need a belt.
So Total Engagement is going to put together, hopefully, a great and fitting living tribute to the man, the myth, the legend, one of the greatest heels in the history of wrestling, Paul Mr. Wonderful Orndorff. It is my pleasure to do, and I hope that you guys go along on this ride and also appreciate the contributions of Mr. Orndorff and people like him.
Total Engagement.
So this interview that's coming up is one that I have wanted to do since I started in podcasting. If you know, I do play music. It is my livelihood. I got involved in podcasting by writing theme songs. I've done a couple theme songs, written a lot of songs that I was asked to write as copies of this guy's songs. Jim Johnston was the guy for the WWF, WWE for a long time. He wrote every theme that you ever heard of. And then they brought in some new people. You know, the ones who did the Sami Zayn song, the ones who did the Asuka song, you know, the Nakamura song, good stuff. But he was kind of marginalized, and then he was let go. He did an interview with Sean Mooney a year ago, but I wanted to get a little deeper from a musical standpoint about what he did. And so we're going to bring you part one of our Jim Johnston interview. I sat down with Jim for a long time. He was very generous with his time. I hope you enjoy it. It was my pleasure to do. Making a very rare podcast appearance, doing a very rare interview to promote an even more unique experience at StarCast 2 Memorial Day weekend. You know, that's part of Double or Nothing weekend. He's doing a live show with Sean Mooney, a behind the music, I think it's called Behind the Themes type show. You don't want to miss it. He did it once before. He talks about it a little bit, but don't miss him at StarCast. But for now, I'm going to try not to be like Chris Farley with Paul McCartney as I introduce to you now the greatest theme songwriter, performer, producer of all time by a mile, Jim Johnston. All right, guys, joining us today, you know who he is. To say that he's an important fixture in wrestling themes is kind of understating the case. It is the man, the myth, the legend, Jim Johnston. How are you doing today, Jim?
I'm doing very well. How about you?
I'm doing fantastic.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. What are you up to these days? What are you doing right now, like musically?
I'm writing a bunch of orchestral stuff and a bunch of songs. The songs are recently have been mainly, I guess, more country influenced, which I love. But just very recently, I've been kind of swerving back to some rock stuff, and I just wrote one that I'm going to record soon, which is dangerously close to a would be a good wrestling theme.
You know, it's a friend of mine told me once that in the music that you think is the best music ever made is usually the music you grew up listening to. And for you in Arkansas, you grew up listening to country music. So for you, is that where you kind of feel the most at home? You know, eventually.
Well, you're right. There's a familiarity there that, it feels familiar and it feels comfortable. It feels like a favorite jacket when you put it on. And I've always simply loved it. And I guess another element in that, Matt, is that for whatever reasons, Vince never liked country music, and I never quite could figure out how much of that was he actually didn't like it, or he was trying to get wrestling away from its Southern profile or something.
Yeah, Vince is very much a self-loathing Southerner, right? You know, he's from like North Carolina. He doesn't like country accents in his announcers. He doesn't like country music. It's kind of a strange thing, huh?
It is a little strange, but there's some logic there too. He when he got into it, he really had this vision, and many elements of that vision, he was successful creating, and one of them was taking this thing that was in fact much more centered in the South, or certainly mid-Atlantic states, and then pockets in the North, and not only make it all across the United States, but all across the globe. And I think he just felt one element of that that was important was to not let it be pegged as a you know, some sort of bizarre deliverance level thing, you know. So my personal taste and personal opinion, and having come from the South, my family coming from the South, I don't particularly agree with that point of view, but I absolutely see why he felt that, and I can't really argue with the result either.
There was a point where you kind of realized maybe you weren't going to be a performer. You know, you've said you've had stage fright even this day. You don't really look to perform. At what point did you decide your role in music was going to be recording, composition, production, as opposed to being a performer?
I think pretty early on, Matt, because the stage fright was there very early on, and I loved music so much that I did some of the high school band thing, but that was really just for a few years in high school. I with a friend in college, we played out at a few like coffee houses, you know, two acoustic guitars and singing thing. But I mean, you're talking about playing to 18 people. So I think the reason I still would always strive to be better was I was hearing things in my head that I was frustrated I couldn't play. So I kept trying to get better to kind of get them out of my system. And I figured if I'm ever going to record this stuff, I'm going to have to be able to play it. And I also noticed rather early on in starting to record that even getting other people, like getting a guitarist much better than me, say, for a guitar part, you can get tons of drummers who can play the absolute part with every little ghosted snare drum, and yet it doesn't sound the same. It doesn't feel the same, and it doesn't feel the same because it's not the same. Just those little differences, you know, it's Mark Knopfler, that just, he really doesn't do that much crazy, spectacular, shredding kind of things on guitar. But the way he plays guitar sounds different than anybody else who plays guitar. Bruce Hornsby, all of his early great records, if you go back and listen, even though he had a band and a drummer, he always used an incredibly simple drum machine for his recordings. And it was the way his piano playing danced around the beat that made those songs come alive. It's for anyone who's studying piano, please go back and listen to his early work, and you will, there's volumes of years of what piano teachers can teach you just by listening and trying to play along with some of those records. He's just brilliant.
And I think from what you're saying, you play piano kind of the way I play piano, which is it still an extension of your guitar playing where like McCartney figured it out? Did you figure it out from guitar and then go from there?
I don't think so, Matt. It's hard to believe that everything you play doesn't impact everything else you play if you play multiple instruments. But after the sort of disaster scenario of version one, of learning to play piano. Version two was I learned to play piano by learning piano parts, not knowing the guitar part and then sitting down and playing it on piano. I mean, I had my crappy little, phono, player up on top of the piano that I could slow down and speed up. And I would just put Martha, My Dear, and I just slow it down, speed it up and figure out those songs. So I learned to play piano on piano stuff. So,
and as far as like you're self-taught, so you've been in a position where you're a musical director. How much self-taught are you? Where you read music, I presume?
I can read the music. Can I read music, like put a piece of piano music in front of me and have me play it? Not at all. No, not in the least.
So,
but I can read it like I know. But and I guess I moved forward in a big way when I first started doing more orchestral stuff, particularly when I would have to be able to write out a part for even, having a solo cello player in, right, much less of doing it for the entire orchestra. So
you can read it, you can write it, but you're not really a sight reader.
No, even the way you just put it there vastly implies I have more gifts in that direction than I do. It's not like I can't quite read it well. It's like, okay, that's a C, that's a D, that's it. No, that's a C sharp. Okay, that's the speed at which I read.
So,
and however, if you just give me something with a chord chart, then I'm, and if I hear the melody one time, I'm pretty much good to go.
Sure. So you get by on that gift with your ear, and then chord charts, of course, are a good way to do it. You know, it's like the old joke. How do you slow a guitar player down? Put a piece of sheet music in front of them,
Yeah, right. Well, that would not slow me down. That would shut the show down.
You got to start working with WBE. You ate at a sushi bar, which is the only one in town, that had five people going to it. One of the guys worked for WBE. He hooks you up with Vince. You start doing some music for WrestleMania and that kind of thing. At some point, you start doing themes for wrestlers. Now, you say you don't remember the first theme you ever did, but those early days, doing Warrior or those kind of things, what was, I've heard you talk about the process. You saw Warrior running, and so you hit that low E string and you start playing some chords. As far as the recording goes, as far as the composition goes, what are you thinking about when you're doing those songs early on?
Well, with Warrior, I think I knew what it was before I even picked the guitar up. I mean, I saw some footage and everything in my being, the only thing I was thinking was this. And I didn't know if that was, my mind wasn't even that far down the road of, is that a guitar? Is that a drum? But something about this piece of music has that in it. Because that's what he is. He's like a some sort of crazy pile driver on cocaine or something.
Right.
I mean, it's just, and then I picked up a guitar and then it was just the chunky notes and then some accent notes over it. And
that's something hard to explain to people, in creating music myself and hearing you talk about it. Sometimes you just see something and then you hear what you want to play, right? It just comes to you, right?
Yeah, it's magical. I don't understand it. I mean, I attribute it a lot to sort of a spiritual thing, which maybe works for me, but maybe anyone who's lucky enough to have any sort of a gift like this, maybe to keep your sanity, you need some way to explain it to yourself or something. It's like, why, how does that work? But I cannot pick up a guitar or sit down at the piano without having a new idea. I just can't. It's not possible. It's never happened. Never. It's never, ever happened.
But when it becomes your job, sometimes the craft of it, you know, where you have to finish it, other times you're being, you know, you have a job to do. Someone wants you to do something and you kind of have to force it a little bit. So it's not a perfect science, right? Because sometimes it's there.
Oh, my God, it's really not. And it works in reverse, too. And I experienced this in my last periods of time at WWE, where I was sort of being sabotaged out of the scene by a group there. And so I wasn't receiving any information about music that was necessary. And so in a strange way, the need for music or that changing so radically in my professional life there sort of shut it down, where it wasn't like I didn't have ideas, musical ideas, when I sat down at the piano or picked up a guitar or picked up a bass guitar. But it's sort of like suddenly this energy had nowhere to go. And so it kind of diffused out. It was a very strange experience for me.
Early on, you know, things were a little bit better with you and Vince. When you started doing themes, I heard you say that at first it was just for the good guys, and that eventually he said, okay, no more crappy music for the bad guys. But what was he looking for? What were you looking for? An extension of the character, you know, a way to enhance the experience. What was your overall goal early on when you're writing these themes?
I'm sure it seems really strange, but it's purely a visceral thing for me. I just get a feel for a character, and I just think about it, or I'll get an idea about a lyric hook idea, in the shower, and then I'll know that's it. That's it.
And you said your process was that Vince would give you something to do, you would hit him back with something, which is usually the case. He'd say you're on the right track, and then you would go and finish it. If you're not on the right track, which happened less often than not, you would start over again. What was your relationship like with Vince? Were you ever friends back in the early days?
Well, he's a complex character, and he, in my opinion, he makes life a whole lot harder for himself and other people and those around him because he can be such a hard ass. But in the strangest imaginable way, when I think of Vince, I've got plenty of sort of lingering issues with him at this point. But essentially, I think of him as a friend, as a friend who kind of went south on me. But I think we were friends to the degree that Vince can be friends. I think it's very difficult for him to have friends because he's been knifed in the back quite a number of times. And so I think like a lot of people who have had those kind of experiences, they're reluctant to trust.
Yeah, sometimes you paint yourself into a corner that way, and that's the only way you can be.
I think, like all things, Matt, the power of habit in our lives is absolutely extraordinary. And, you know, if you've been doing things that are bad habits, you would think logically you would stop doing those things, but we don't. We keep doing them. And so it's all about trying to do good habits. There's so much positive there, and I feel bad on many levels that our relationship ended the way it did.
But when things were good, you know, and he asked you to do these songs, you're doing, you know, different kind of songs for a lot of people. You start doing some bad guy songs, you know, and when I think of early songs that for a bad guy, you know, I think of Mr. Perfect, you know, that Mr. Perfect theme, that grandiose over the top theme, something like that. Was that an idea that just came to you and you developed it tonally, or you knew you wanted horns, or how did something like that take place?
I think music for bad guys always comes down to, do you believe how great I am? Can you believe it? And Mr. Perfect was a really strong character, and he played it really well. He was charismatically bad, and he really exuded that when he came out, you know, with the hands up in the air and the like, and that was his vibe. Is you know, come on now, it's a little hard to believe how great I am, isn't it? I mean, it's hard for me to believe, for God's sake. So that was, you know, his. I think what I knew it started. It was like you know, it's like, here I am. It's like a monumental concerto to himself. Awesome. Whereas music for good guys is more a celebration for everyone. It's more coming out and going out to the crowd. It's almost like this is what the crowd feels about you, and how much we love you and how much we're supporting you. And bad guys, I think it comes more from, it's all about them. So it's what, how they see themselves.
You know, and I think I heard you talk about that. I thought it was really interesting where you said some music is from the wrestler's point of view, and then other, you know, music, and in particular, you were talking about the Undertaker's music, had more to do with, from the outside, the perception, the, you know, the feeling you get from the outside looking in. And it's interesting to me that you thought that deeply, where you're thinking, okay, who is this point of view coming from? Was that something you consciously did, or it just popped up once in a while?
No, utterly subconscious. It's just, that's the way it felt. Everything for me, Matt, is how it feels. If it doesn't make you feel something, then it's an unsuccessful piece of music. But, you know, like Austin is another example. It's his music is us looking at him and celebrating him for who he is, in the same spirit that Steve would never say, like, hey, you better watch out for me because I'm a dangerous character. I'm a rattlesnake. God, you never know what's going to happen when I come out, you know, God, because I'm a crazy, cool guy, and holy crow, so you better be careful. You know, he's way too cool to ever go down that road. Right. And so he's also too cool to have this music coming from him that says, I'm so cool. It's like he happens to be there almost while we, the crowd, decided to play that music.
But you're saying this is on a subconscious level, so you're looking at it now like that, but then you're just playing what you think works.
Well, I'm playing stuff, and then when I get that feeling that, like, if it's a heel guy, that, yeah, this, I feel like I'm celebrating myself. Yeah. So this is the right road. And I wouldn't even, Matt, I wouldn't even go that way. I mean, I wouldn't even go that far in terms of a verbal explanation about it. It would be like, this doesn't feel right. This just doesn't feel right for him. Doesn't fit this guy. This is not the right music.
As the Attitude Era arrives, you know, you start working with other people, you know, you start working with different partnerships. I'm kind of curious about what it was like with these partners. Like, you worked with Motorhead on Triple H song. What is that? Yeah. Is that a thing where you wrote the song, or you worked with them, or how does that kind of thing work?
Motorhead did three of my songs. They're they're my songs.
So you wrote those songs lock, stock, and barrel, and then presented them, and they played them for you.
Yes.
That's awesome.
And yeah. I know Lemmy changed like two lines on something that Triple H naturally made him change without consulting the actual writer of the song. And I actually think that Lemmy, who was a wild and crazy guy, but he was a pretty class act himself at the end of the day. I think that he was uncomfortable with that because he would know how he would feel if someone took one of his songs and decided to just change the lyrics. It's kind of an unwritten code. You just don't do that.
Oh, absolutely. Because when you write something, you have ownership of it. You have investment in it. And if somebody goes around you to change it, it's like someone changing the outfit on your baby without your permission.
Well, and in this case, we're talking about, and hey, I get that it's his entrance music, but I think it's a dangerous thing when Triple H decides that he's a composer or a lyricist. And I think that the changes did not make the song better.
Yeah, that's
got it. I mean, they barely changed anything. It's just it really is the principle of the thing. Yeah. But I know that in the case of, I think King of Kings was the second. There was the game.
Evolution.
Evolution and King of Kings. But by whether King of Kings was the second or the third, by the time that came around, I did my best Lemmy impression on the vocal, the reference vocal. The king. The king of kings.
I got to tell you. Evolution is slamming, man. I love that song. Is that one you have, like, is the last one you did with Motorhead, so you kind of maybe had the process down and you knew exactly what you wanted from them?
No, I think that was the first.
Oh, was it?
I think that was the first, and then they used others for a while, but I think then they came around to the game. Interesting, one of the interesting things about the game, and another, sorry, Paul, but... you did it to yourself, that, you know, I ended up remixing that song because I thought it didn't sound, the recording didn't sound good. And part of that was Lemmy's style of bass guitar. He always played through, I think it was a Bandmaster or a bass, it was a Bandmaster. With his bass guitar and had it, you know, always up to 10. So it completely broke up the speakers. And that's what gave him his tone, which sounded great. The negative was there wasn't a lot of low bass to it. So when I got the mix back, I wanted that. So I played a whole nother octave down bass on the song and put a bunch of sub bass into the song. So it had some nuts to it. And, of course, people downstream saying, now, you know, Motorhead did that mix. Now, that's a good mix. That's better than your mixes, Jim. And it's like, well, okay, great. That is my mix.
And, you know, in this time where you're the guy, you know, and even creating customized music for a company, not just wrestling, it was very unusual, you know. So you kind of are making your own way as you become an employee, you know, and you're the guy. And in 2013, they started bringing in some other people, a CFO, using them for a couple people, you know, a lot, and then for the NXT brand, and then the Raw and SmackDown theme. Now, for you, is that something you felt you were getting cut out of, or was it like your workload was too much? How did you feel when other people were being brought in to start doing the music all of a sudden?
Well, I was getting cut out. That was that was by design, not necessarily Vince's design, but by other folk. It's his company. He can do whatever the hell he wants with it. You know, it isn't like he owes me a job or something. But at the same time, fast forward, and I hope that someone over there is smart enough to see what they got, because now they have a bunch of generic music that means nothing.
When that started happening, you were still contributing music. You know, for a while, it was a coexistence where you're still contributing, writing music, you know, to the time that you left. What was that process like? Would they come to you for a song here and there, or were you feeling things slowly slipping away?
I was feeling things slowly slipping away. Yeah. And I was seeing a lot of stuff that was sort of invisible, on getting the network up and running. There was a ton of work involved of just getting a network filled up with content and going back and, you know, just day to day crap stuff of going back to old themes, going back and finding the mix somewhere and making something that was mono stereo. I felt stuff. Felt it was slipping away, that I was kind of being fairly well sabotaged, and it was working.
But it wasn't overt. Like, it wasn't like someone was coming to you and saying, here's the direction we're going in now. Is that something that you're, you know, makes you feel kind of unappreciated, that they weren't kind of upfront with you about they were going in a different direction?
I don't think early on that even they... it's easy to say they, but it all comes down to Vince, because there's no big decisions. So how people spin things to Vince, you know, he can only make decisions based on the information he has. I really didn't have access to Vince through this period, but others did. When Hunter was running NXT, he was working with the CFOs to do that music. And then the original plan, of course, was when someone comes up from the Farm League, which was NXT, then we take a fresh look at them, their character, they get new music, and then that just evolved a different way, where when you got called up, you came exactly as you were with your existing music, your character intact. And then, and I think that's when overall, my opinion, where the product started getting just horribly generic and homogenized, was they just started wholesale bringing people in, and there were just this incredible slew of new characters all the time. And, you know, you can only go down the road so far with saying these two guys hate each other when the audience has no reason whatsoever to believe or understand that these two people hate each other, other than, man, I really hate that guy. I really do. You know, it's stuff. You have to have a story, as you have to know why. You know, hey, Joe stole Ed's girl, and now Ed is really mad. Okay, I get that.
With you seeing that this style of music is less and less appreciated, less and less important, your contributions becoming less and less a percentage of the overall product. There was a time over a year ago where everybody was surprised that Jim Johnston is no longer with WWE. Mm-hmm. When that happened, was that something that surprised you?
No, because I knew this was coming to an end, and particularly maybe for the last year, I knew that the writing's on the wall. Is like this guy has pushed me out. And but you know, I was so, I don't know, so discouraged by it all, and I wasn't doing what I want to do, which is to write great music. And I'm a worker. I don't want a job where I don't have to work. There wasn't ever a millisecond where I thought, wow, isn't this great? I'm really not doing that much music, but they're continuing to pay me. Oh my God, what a great deal. It was awful. I hate that. I hated that feeling. Is like, I've got handcuffs on. I can't contribute. And I eventually told Vince that as well. I said, this is not right. So I also told him at the time, is like, hey, if you're unhappy with me, fire me. Fire me right now. You can fire me right now. I'm taking the pressure off you. Go ahead, fire me. Because, you know, that's not the way I roll. I don't like that.
So it's fair to say that towards the end, you kind of pushed the issue because you were letting it be known that you were unhappy with not contributing the way you wanted to.
I had my one meeting with Vince, and ultimately nothing changed. And then suddenly I got a meeting planner one day that I had a meeting in Vince's office the next afternoon. And I knew in an instant, it's like, okay, I'm tomorrow at 4, I'm being fired.
Was that a feeling of relief or a feeling of dread, or were you, you know, just a eventuality?
Unavoidable eventuality. Some maybe hope for relief, you know, not it. Humans are not built for change. We just don't accept change well. Even if it's a change we look forward to and like. So yeah, there was a lot of there was all the usual suspects: sadness, fear. Hey, I felt all of them, and bitterness, certainly anger, because. It was just a lot of lies, and lying's not a good thing.
Without getting into like a blame game or something like that, what are the ways that you feel you were dealt with dishonestly?
I don't want to go into it. Yeah, it's just no upside there. But
fair enough.
But yeah, it was a scary time, but. It was a very brief event, because after he said his piece, I was like, okay. And I stood up and left.
Things are kind of going crazy in the wrestling business right now. There's a lot of different companies coming up, that kind of thing. Have you been approached by anybody to make any wrestling themes, you know, in the last couple years or so outside of WWE?
Softly and indirectly, but no, not very recently. And I agree, I don't even follow it, but just recently it feels like there has been the difference being it feels like there are serious players, a couple of serious players entering the market who really see that WWE has fallen into a place of weakness, and that they are vulnerable.
So hypothetically,
and I believe that's true.
And that being what it is, hypothetically, if a Tony Khan and Cody Rhodes, who have this new company, All Elite Wrestling, came to you and wanted a couple songs, that would be a conversation you would be open to having.
Sure, absolutely. Give me a call.
in Chicago, Labor Day weekend, this past one, you did a live presentation. People were very excited about it. You were interviewed by Sean Mooney about, you know, in front of a live crowd, almost like performing. You're going to be doing it at StarCast. You're going to be doing it again this Memorial weekend as part of, you know, Double or Nothing weekend that's going on. But as part of StarCast, how much is this something you look forward to? Are you excited about hearing from people, how much they enjoy your songs? What is your thoughts about your StarCast presentation?
The one in Chicago I did with great trepidation and tremendous fear and hesitancy, but I was so blown away, grateful and humbled by the reaction of the people who came. I was amazed. And I go into this next one with the same fear and questions and why am I doing this? And, you know, no one will show up. And why would anyone be interested in hearing about this? And, you know, you'll probably pass out on stage or you'll trip down the stairs and every possible, you know, classic stage fright scenario that you can come up with. But it's probably healthy to get out. I live a secluded life here in my studio, and to get out and get some air is probably a healthy thing. So I'm pushing myself to do it. And Conrad's kind enough to ask me back, so that's nice.
Definitely, Conrad's a huge fan, and I remember when he first talked about that idea with me and a couple of friends. We were just saying how fantastic it was, and we hope you're looking forward to it. And I just want to thank you so much for your time. I hope you've enjoyed this interview. I know you don't do a lot of it. Thank you so much.
It's nice, and I appreciate your steering it over to the music side, because, you know, which is kind of ironic or paradoxical, or I don't know exactly the right word, but I've never really been a wrestling fan. So when I've done, as you say, these very few things, and when it stays on the wrestling end of things, I have difficulty, I guess, speaking with any authority, because I don't feel like it's something that I know much about. But music and how... And the power of music to stir emotions and take us from our state where we are now to a totally different state within seconds is genuinely a force that's beyond my explanation. It's incredible. You can be brokenheartedly sad, hear the right piece of music, and be laughing in seconds.
Total engagement.
Yeah, so that's it, guys. Yeah, so pretty damn full show, huh, guys? I hope you enjoy it. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Matt Coon, T-E, but also check out our Patreon page. You can get that full Jim Johnston interview and now on audio, and probably within a day or so on video. And we'll probably throw on some extra stuff this week, too. So make sure to get on board with the brand new Patreon site. Guys, I think it's been a great episode. We didn't have the bits this week, but I want to hear your feedback, because we want you to be totally engaged on Total Engagement.
The world of MLW Radio never stops.